believe we were in the blessing that speaks about the returning of the judges. And we ask God that he should return the judges and the advisors as before, and he should remove from us two types of problems. One is, we mentioned the actual, when a person is actually suffering, so he sighs, sorrow. And then the first thing it mentions is yagon. The word in Hebrew is yagon. Yagon means when a person is troubled but he does not know the cause. And this is a very interesting thing, because the Talmud, Yerushalmi, states, that's the Jerusalem Talmud, states that where the verse, on the verse in Exodus, where God says, I'll remove from you all illness, so the rabbis say, what is meant by the extra word all? And we know that in the Torah, there's no such thing as an extra word. And when there is an inclusive term which precedes a noun, the inclusive term is a specific reference to something. So the rabbis say that all diseases means mental diseases. They call it rayon, which means of the mind. And the Talmud says that this type of illness, which is illness of the mind, where a person is distraught and troubled and he can't get down to the cause, this is the worst of all illnesses. It's an amazing statement of the Talmud. It shows you that in the oral law, which was given down from Sinai, that there was very deep psychology, a lot of insight in terms of human psychology, and they recognize that the worst disease is the mental illness. And I believe Ernest Jones, who was a student of Freud, writes that the reason why mental illness is the worst, he says, even if a person is dying from cancer, he can escape into his mind, but the person who's suffering from mental illness has absolutely no release. There is never a time when he's free. So here we ask God to bring back the judges and the advisors as of old, and he should remove from us these two types of tragedies, the one where we have conscious pain from something that bad that occurs, and also what we would term in psychoanalytic modern terms, unconscious pain. It shows you also that how is God going to remove that pain? So it says through the advisors, the advisors as they were in the past. So we see from this that there was some kind of a therapeutic process that they used, advisors used, in order to help it relieve a person from inner tension that he's not aware of. And that's why we ask God to return to us those advisors, so that we could once again be free from inner tensions that we just don't know where they come from, because we're ignorant of our own nature. We ask God to bring us back these advisors who can give us the knowledge and the wisdom. The idea here of counseling is clear, but it's the difference between the counseling of the Torah and the counseling that we have today is that the counselor of the Torah has to know the psyche as well as the soul. Today's counselors know the psyche, perhaps to a degree, but they do not have any knowledge of the soul whatsoever. So the true counselor has to know both, because a man cannot be happy, a man or a woman cannot be happy, unless they have a harmony existing between the three parts of man, the body and the psyche, and also the soul. So the soul of man is the part of man that recognizes ideas and thoughts and concepts, knowledge, and God. And that part of man is extremely important for human happiness. You cannot attain happiness without that. Of course, psychological problems can disturb a person and remove him from happiness as well, and as well as physical problems. And that's why we ask God over here. We already prayed for the physical before, so now we ask God for the psychological, and he should give us his advisors and his judges, so they could help us remove the anguish and the unconscious despair that we experience, as well as other problems that we have. And through their sage advice, they can help us. You know, it's one of the principles of Maimonides' guide is that most of the problems in a person's life do not stem from God, so to speak. They don't come from the situation. They come from the person themselves. He says over 90% of a person's problems are usually self-inflicted. So that's why over here we ask for the wise judges and advisors of the past, so they can guide us through life and teach us how to avoid most of our own problems that we produce ourselves, that we make ourselves, and as well, those are the conscious problems, as well as those unconscious problems which cause us an uneasiness and a tension and perhaps a depression, which we're not aware of what the source of these feelings are. Okay? And then we say that God should reign upon us alone, and that word alone is important because it means God alone means that we cannot have any feelings that are reserved towards the Creator. Those feelings of God, that God is the ruler, cannot be expressed towards anything else or anything or any being besides God. So we say God alone should reign upon us with kindness and with compassion, and he should make us righteous with justice. So that we should be a people that live a just existence. Now, this is justice in Torah is extremely important. You see, the first commandments that we received after Sinai are really commandments with regard to justice. And it says in Exodus. I don't know if there's so much here. I'll get it in a minute. As it says, I don't study. My background is not chapter and verse. So whenever I teach Ibnei Noach, I always have to look it up first and then give you the chapters. Now, it is chapter 21, okay, in Exodus 21. It says, and these are the judgments that you shall set before them. And the reason for this is that judgment in Torah is extremely important. A person can be extremely religious and yet not be just. And that is because religion could be used as a very self-seeking, egoistic type of thing, where a person feels that he's egocentric and he feels that the most important thing in the universe is his existence, and therefore God is concerned, mainly, the main concern is about him. And when people get into this frame of mind, we find individuals who could be very religious, they could pray and act very religiously, and yet we find how they could do something which is dishonest, and including stealing, being unjust towards people. And the reason is very simple, because if religion is self-seeking, it serves the self, and the person thinks that God is concerned about him, so certainly he thinks God would be happy that he should have this money, and he doesn't experience any guilt in taking something which is not his, because he is the most important person, and certainly this is what God would want. This kind of an idea is a corrupt one, and it's one which shows that the person's entire religious motivation is at fault and has a wrong basis and is worthless, basically. So that's why after the event at Sinai, the first thing we was given was judgments. Judgments means, when we say judgment, it means the person has to recognize that just like you feel God is concerned about you, he's just as concerned about the other fellow. And in God's system, you and the other fellow are equal. Your fellow man are equal. So justice is a concept where a person gets out of the self and recognizes that there's more than just he, and that there are many he's in existence, and God is concerned about all of them equally, and therefore he subordinates his own egocentricity to the concept of justice. That's why justice is most important. The way you could tell a just person, a religious person, is by his justice, how just he is, how fair he is, how honest he is in business. You know, the Talmud tells a story. Talmud says that what is meant by the fear of God? What do we mean when we say a person is God-fearing? So the Talmud says that the story of a great sage who wanted to sell an object, and he was sitting in the marketplace, and then he decided it was time to read the Shema. So someone approached him and offered him X amount of dollars for the item, and he was in the middle of Shema and couldn't answer. So the prospective buyer thought that he didn't want to sell it to him at that price. So he kept on going higher. He said, okay, I'll give you more. And he he didn't answer again because he was in the middle of reciting the Shema, and he kept on going higher. And after the sage got finished with the Shema, he told him, he says, the object is yours, but at the first price, because that's what I really wanted to sell it for. The Talmud says that is what we mean when we say a man fears God. Because if a man fears God, then he is honest with regard to his, insofar as the monetary world is concerned, financial honesty. And he knows that God knows what was in his heart. And at that moment, the first moment he wanted to sell, so then he forfeits the profit and honestly gives the person the item at the lowest price. That, the Talmud says, that is fear of God. So you'll notice the Talmud doesn't say fear of God is how intently the person recited the Shema or how religious he looked in appearance. That is not greatness. Greatness is the honesty insofar as the world, the monetary world is concerned, insofar as his own possessions are concerned, insofar as another human being's money is concerned. That is greatness, and that is justice. That's why we say that God should make us righteous through justice, which means that we aspire to a level that we should be considered righteous in the world where justice prevails. That is the test. That is the test. I often say about fellow Jews, I say, if I were to try to determine how righteous another person was, of course that's not our job. I'm just saying hypothetically, but I would rather look at his income tax return than look at his phylacteries. You know, phylacteries is of course is something which people always associate with religiosity. But if a person cheats on his income tax, then he is actually stealing, and according to the Torah, that's absolutely prohibited. But there are many people who feel they're religious, but when it comes to the government, well, I'm not really in agreement with what the government's doing. They're not spending their money the way I see fit, and it doesn't really matter. It's an awful lot of money. The national debt is very big anyways, and my few dollars are not going to make a difference. So if I can distort a little bit on my income tax return, that's all fine and wonderful. This the Torah is against, because that's where you see the halacha comes in, the idea of Torah law. The law states this is considered stealing, because the government, according to Torah, the government has sovereignty. And sovereignty means it owns the properties and the land, that it's an ownership. Just like there's a personal ownership, there's a governmental ownership. Talmud deduces this, by the way, from a toll bridge, because you see that the government sets up a toll bridge, and halachically you are not permitted to slip through the toll and not pay. A person could be a thief for a small amount of money, too. Sometimes you find people, there are different kinds of individuals. Sometimes you find a person that will steal a quarter, never steal a lot of money, and sometimes you'll find people that will steal large sums and not small sums. So, according to Torah, it makes no difference, really. Either one is a thief. And even if a person should steal one penny, he's considered a thief. Because justice is at the penny. Justice is a concept. I know some people, I remember telling someone about this idea, and they just couldn't grasp the idea. They said, I can't believe 10 cents. What difference does it make? See, but that's not halacha. Halacha is very exact. It's based upon an idea and an ideal. And that ideal is true whether you're dealing with a penny or with $1 million. That's why the Talmud states that when the rabbis would get together for a case of judgment, they would judge a case that involved a penny just as seriously and just as intently, and they would work just as assiduously as they would if they were dealing with a case that was $1 million. Because justice is the same whether it's a penny or whether it's $1 million. It's a concept. It means fairness. And one penny off, the equation is broken. And that's when it doesn't exist. Justice doesn't prevail then. So this is the idea of Torah justice is one which can't be compromised. It has to be exact. And this is important for the Ben Israel as well as for the Ben Noach. And we have to realize that the Torah demands honesty with regard to monetary matters. And there are many, we call it in halacha, it's called mora heter. It means people teach themselves to do something that's prohibited by saying it's permissible. Certain things we can very easily convince ourselves. We rationalize away certain types of sins. But this is considered a very serious matter. And halacha dictates that whatever belongs to an individual, to a government, it doesn't matter who it is, whenever the halacha states that this person has ownership, you cannot infringe upon that ownership one iota. And that's an important thing. That's why one of the laws, of the seven laws, as you know, is to refrain from stealing. And this doesn't mean this doesn't just mean that you shouldn't go to a department store and walk off with goods. It means to cheat even on a penny. The smallest amount is prohibited when it comes to stealing, when it comes to taking anything. Because justice must be precise and exact. And it's considered a very serious offense. So justice is more, people think of justice in terms of, well, I'm not really harming the other person. If I say, well, a few cents aren't going to matter, he's not going to know the difference. That's not the idea. That is, not to harm somebody is a separate thing. But the idea of ownership is a concept. It's an ideal. The ideal is that God gave each man certain rights of ownership. And infringing on that right, even in the slightest amount, is an infringement on God's system. Because God gave that system and he demanded perfection. As a matter of fact, the generation of the flood. So if you look at the beginning of Genesis, it states that they were filled with robbery. And the Talmud says that, of course, it says before they were committing many sins, but right before the flood it states that they were filled with robbery. And the Talmud states that why did the Torah mention this again? And as a matter of fact, it's in Genesis 5, verse 13. And God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with robbery through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth." So the Talmud says that the final point which caused God, the final straw, the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, was robbery. Because once you take away the concept of another human being having God-endowed rights of property and ownership, then you're destroying the entire concept of man, societally as well as personally. So the Torah is extremely cautious about that. As a matter of fact, the Talmud states that what they would do is doesn't necessarily mean they would just rob. It says they would see an individual who is selling grapes, for instance. So they'd go over and each one would take one grape, and by the time before you know it, the man didn't have anything left to sell. But the stealing begins at the smallest amount, because it's a violation of a right. It's a concept. It's an ideal. That is an important point. Most people don't see it that way. Most people see it as, well, what does it really matter? I'm just harming the other person. Not a matter of harming. It's an ideal, and a concept. And when you break that concept, even at the smallest level, you're breaking God's idea. And when you do that, it's a major violation. And that is true, again, for a Ben Noach as well as for a Ben Israel. So this is something which we should always keep in mind. And that's what this blessing really is, to raise us to the level of recognition of true justice on a conceptual level, not just on an emotional level where we say, well, look, what does it matter? You know, this I won't steal a lot of money, but a small amount is okay. It's an ideal. Okay. Now we say, we conclude the blessing, and we say, blessed are you, God, the King who loves righteousness and justice. Okay? Now, righteousness and justice are two different things. What is the difference between justice and righteousness? See, when we say the word tzedakah, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but tzedakah really means charity. It's an interesting term for charity. But when we say, and the word in Hebrew, tzedek means basically what is right. That's what tzedek means. It means what is right. So righteousness, the translation, has a connotation, a little bit of religiosity, which is a little bit over what the Hebrew word really means. Tzedek means what is correct. Okay, what is correct. So it's an interesting thing. When we say that we give charity, we don't really consider it such a great act that it's done, it's over and above what we're supposed to do. It's considered right. See, righteousness should be changed. It should be rightness. That would be a better term, rightness. Okay, so we say God loves rightness and he loves justice. Now, justice is where you have, let's say, two litigants. Okay, by the way, that's why the Torah says in Exodus that you're not permitted, in that very same chapter where it speaks about the laws, after the giving of Torah Sinai, so one of the things is you should not make a poor man raise him. You shouldn't raise his importance in an argument. Okay, that's something which is. See, people have emotions both ways. Sometimes people say, "Well, poor man, we might as well step on him because he really doesn't have too much power." And that happens to be true, that people who are poor don't have as much say as people who are wealthy in any society. But so there's a tendency to step on the poor, so to speak. And that is, of course, an injustice. We all understand that. But then there's an opposite tendency sometimes. The opposite tendency is to say, well, you see, this person is so poor, he could really use the money. So therefore, this wealthy man, to him, it means nothing. But this poor fellow, it would be wonderful if he could get a few dollars. So why don't we just twist this one around a little bit and let the poor man come out on top in this case. That is injustice. That's what happens today in our society when you have a man going against a big company. So the big company knows that they can't win because the jury's going to favor the poor individual and they're going to say, what the heck, this big company has plenty of money. No problem there. Let's just shift it over to this poor guy. They probably won't even feel it. This is considered, in the eyes of the Torah, a major violation. Of course, it's a distortion, again, of the concept of justice. And we say God loves justice. And because God loves justice, he doesn't like any kind of distortion, which means no matter how poor the fellow is, he could be starving. But the fact is that in his claim against the wealthy man, if the wealthy man is right, you've got to take that money away from the poor man. Now, that's a very hard thing to do. Because this poor fellow, you know, it may be he really is in dire need. So it is true that we, whenever we collect from a poor person, we make sure he has minimal amount of survival. And there's a whole system of how he has his house and whatever, you know, a basic allotment that the Torah gives to a poor person. We don't just take everything away. But nevertheless, we're taking away, he's going to be living, struggling, and this other fellow could be extremely wealthy. We say, no, we have to exact the money from the poor man. And why? Because that's justice. God loves justice. He doesn't like a distortion. God likes charity, too. If you want to give the poor man charity, that's wonderful. That's rightness. That's correct. But don't mix charity and justice. These are two discrete, separate concepts. And God is a lover of both things, but God doesn't like a distortion of justice. That's not a way to give charity, to distort justice and to take the money away from the wealthy man. The wealthy man is entitled to what is his according to the laws of the judgment and justice. And then if the poor man doesn't have, well, then we should give him charity. That's our responsibility. But you don't give charity by awarding the money from the other litigant. That's not charity. That's corruption. So here, that's why we say God loves justice and he loves righteousness, meaning rightness means like to give charity. By the way, the fact that we say that to give charity is rightness shows us that it's not something which is such a big deal. We shouldn't look at charity as such a big deal. Charity is, it's right. We should recognize this is the right thing to do. If we have more than another person, God was good to us, and this other person is struggling, and he's in need, then it's the right thing to do to give him money. It's not such a gregarious thing. We're not so great. It's not something that's above and beyond the call of duty. It's something which is right, and that's why we call it by the word of tzedakah. So there is a time for rightness, such as charity, and then there's a time for justice. But these are two separate concepts, and they mustn't be crossed. Then if they are, then you have distortion. And that's why the prayer ends with that. We say God loves righteousness and justice, two different things. Okay, again, from this prayer we see that when God will reign over us and he will help us, the way that he will help us, one of the ways is, of course, by giving us individuals who can teach us and give us knowledge. That is, again, the primary aspect of Torah to... for a person to constantly be in a situation where he can gain knowledge. Okay, now, the next blessing that we're going to take is one which I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's something which has a kind of an emotional tinge to it, I might say. All right, it's a blessing where we ask for people to be destroyed and cut off and uprooted. Now this blessing was added in the time of Rabban Gamliel. That's about the around the second century, beginning of the second century. And Maimonides states that the reason why this blessing was added at that time because at that time there was a great influx of people who were what we call apikorsen. Apikorsen means that they're heretics. And these heretics weren't just people who simply disbelieved in the Torah, but they used to cause those who believed in Torah, they used to torment them, and they used to try their best to influence them to leave the Torah. Now, this is considered not just something which is like a misdemeanor. This is considered a serious, the most serious infraction. If you take a look at people, you see, you have to understand this is an important point over here also. Everything we touch in Torah brings up concepts, universal concepts, outside of the realm that we are dealing with immediately. We're dealing with prayer, but now we're going to touch on certain things that are major ideas in Torah. And if you take a look at Deuteronomy, okay, 13:7, it says, "If thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, who is as thy own soul, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers, of the gods of the peoples who are around about you, either near to thee or far from thee, from the one end of the earth even to the other end of the earth. Thou shalt not consent to him, nor hearken to him, nor shall thy eye pity him." So Deuteronomy states, that thou shalt not, if an individual tries to...
Rabbi, yes. Just a moment. What is that, Gail? All right, you're looking at 13, you're in Deuteronomy 13:6, correct?
7 in mine.
All right. You know, yours is usually, is usually one off.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah, you know, as when we've done this Isaiah thing, yours is usually one ahead of us.
Oh, I didn't realize it's over here the same way.
Okay, all right, so you're ready to go again. All right, take off.
So if this individual, tries to entice you to follow these strange gods, so we say you shouldn't consent to him, you shouldn't listen to him, and your eye should not pity him, nor should you spare him, nor should you conceal him, but thou shalt surely kill him. Thy hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. Okay? And thou shalt stone him with stones that he should die, because he has sought to draw thee away from the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Mitzrayim, land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. And all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you. So, you see over here that the Torah is not of the opinion that we should just be kind and loving. This is an idea that was introduced by other religions, not the Torah. The Torah states openly over here that you should not have pity on this person. And it's speaking about what kind of a person? It's speaking about a person that may be your brother. The Torah specifically mentions, spells out the people, your brother, your son, your mother, or your daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or your friend, the closest people in the world to you. When you see that the Torah is being destroyed, you cannot have any sympathy for such people, and you must do whatever is necessary in order to bring them to court and then have them suffer the death penalty. So the Torah is not a system of just unmitigated, unqualified kindness and loving. Yes, it's true. God is loving, but it's not just emotionally loving. It's loving in a way which leads to the benefit of all of mankind. And if there are people that are destroying that benefit, then these people cannot have any mercy or any pity on these people. And as a matter of fact, having mercy and pity and trying to save these people is ipso facto destroying righteous people, good people. And that is the worst thing in the eyes of God. So that we always say that the Talmud states that a person who has pity on a corrupt, evil individual will eventually be evil to good people. Why? Because it shows you that he's just moved emotionally by the moment. He's really not concerned about humanity. He doesn't have any objective kind of system. We have a system of love, but that system of love is based on rationality, on knowledge, not just emotion. Emotion is fine if the mind sees, yes, this is a wonderful person, we should feel sorry, we should help him. But if it's a wicked person, as much as we feel sorry for that person, we must destroy that individual, because they will destroy others. And that's why the image of a person like a Mother Teresa is not really considered in Torah, that's not considered a righteous person, that kind of an image, because a person who is righteous is one who could be kind, very kind, and also, on the other hand, when necessary, can be very cruel, when it's necessary. Samuel was a prophet. He was a great and righteous person. But when Agag, the king of Amalek, was brought to him, he killed him with a sword, and he cut him in half. So the Torah demands that a person be able to use emotions of cruelty as well, when the mind tells them that this is the kindest thing to do for humanity, this is the right thing to do. So the emotions must be guided based upon the intellect, the mind, and in terms of all of the good for humanity, not, it shouldn't be, the good for humanity should not be compromised because of my personal emotions towards a specific individual who, in fact, is evil. And that's what the Torah is saying in Deuteronomy 13, 7 through 12. Yours is 6 through 11. This is an important and a very important concept. Most people, you know, it is mentioned a few times in Torah. Torah says also that a person is a murderer. You shouldn't have mercy on him. You shouldn't try to save him. You shouldn't try to cover him up. The covering up of evil people is something which destroys mankind. And people who stand by and watch an evil person destroy a righteous person it is as if they themselves are being involved in that destruction. So those who stood by, well, during the Holocaust or during any kind of situation like that, wherever humanity is being destroyed, and do not move in and destroy the evil people, are themselves actually evil in the eyes of the Torah. Now, there's an interesting story which the Talmud brings down, mentions, and I think it's applicable over here, because the story is about the wife of Rabbi Meir, great scholar, and his wife, whose name was Bruria. And the Talmud tells us that that Rabbi Meir had neighbors who were tormenting him, who were bothering him. And so he said to his wife, he says, "I will pray to God that they will cease to exist." So his wife, Bruria, said, "You shouldn't do that." And she said, because it says in the the story goes as follows, that So she said to him, she says, "You shouldn't pray to God that they should be destroyed, because the verse in Psalms 104 says that it says the sinners." Well, see, it's a little bit difficult, but you have to know a little bit of Hebrew here. The word is chatoim. Chatoim means sins. So the verse in Psalms 104 states that the way she read it was that the sins will cease, and therefore the wicked will cease to exist. It's in 104, Psalms 35. Okay, the very, very last verse. "The sinners will be consumed out of the earth, and the wicked will be no more." So the word for sinners over here is chato'im. But chato'im really means sins, okay? So she said, you see the way the psalm is formulated? It says the sins will cease from the land, and therefore there will be no more wicked. So she said that you should pray that they should cease to be sinful, not that they should be destroyed. Okay? So the Rabbi Meir, when he heard this interpretation, he said, "That's correct." And from then on, he changed his prayer. So the point is here, this would seem to be contradictory to what we just said, that sometimes we must try to remove and to actually annihilate the wicked, and that's what this prayer is for. This the prayer that we're discussing now. But Rabbi Soloveitchik gave a very beautiful and correct answer. He says the word. I'm sorry about the Hebrew, but let me just go through it anyway. The word chato'im means sins, but it also means sinners. But there are two words for sinners. One word for sinner is chot'im. Another word for sinner is chato'im. That's the word we were speaking about before. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, what is the difference between those two? He said, a chote means a person who performs a sin. That's what the verb means. A person performs a sin. chatoim means the person's essence is sin. And if you know Hebrew, you would recognize immediately that that is correct. As a matter of fact, when it talks about the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, it doesn't say they were sinners, chotim, but it says they were chatoim, which means their essence was sin. So that's really what the wife of Rabbi Meir was telling the rabbi, that these people aren't really essentially evil. They may torment you, and they may be partaking, they may be sinners, but they're not essentially evil. So if people are only sinners, then you shouldn't pray for them to be destroyed. You should pray for them to change their ways, that they should see the correct way of life and abandon their sins. But that is when a person is a sinner. But if a person is essentially sin, chatoim, then the only thing to do is to remove them, because that's their essence, and you cannot change them. Now, that's why this prayer was introduced, because at that time, there were people who, as Maimonides states, were, when we say apocryphal, it means they were heretics, which means they denied the Torah, denied God, and they used to torment those who kept the Torah, and they would also try to entice them.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Based on the dating that you gave this, would you assume this is directed primarily at the Nazarene Messianic movement, the
yes.
Christians?
Yes, the history...
Okay, hold on, let me turn it back off and go ahead from there. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Maimonides does not say that, but the history texts, the history books, encyclopedias do say that it was directed at that time against the followers of Jesus, the early Christians. And it seems that they would cause the Pharisees great problems by... getting them, having them brought to have the government really condemning them and torturing them, and also they would cause other Jews to accept these ideas, which were essentially heretical. So that's what. And I haven't checked out. See, Maimonides doesn't say that, but I notice encyclopedias that do say that. And it could very well be correct. I'd have to research it further to give you a fully accurate answer. But it is possible. I mean, the point is that was that a time, perhaps David knows better, was that a time when the early followers of Jesus, the Ebionites, were gaining ground, and when were they, in fact, causing these problems? I mean, I don't know.
The answer is that in this period that the Messianic, Nazarene Messianic movement is moving along at a real good pace, and the Sanhedrin has been moved to Yavner.
Right.
And there's a big fight between the Sadducees, the Pharisees at Yavner, and these the Messianics, and that would be the heresy, but it cannot be misunderstood with anything that applies to Christianity today, because what is being practiced today is nothing what these people practiced back then. But the heresy would be that they were pulling them away from Pharisaical Judaism into the Messianic Nazarene sect.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that historical note. And therefore, but the idea was that the concept is that when there are people that are really bent on evil and doing evil towards their fellow man, and especially, as Maimonides states, enticing others to go away from the ideas of Torah. Now, in the Bible, the Deuteronomy that I mentioned before, it speaks about going away to following strange gods. But I want you to know something, that strange gods means any deviation from the idea of God. There cannot be the slightest deviation from the proper notion of God. Once there is the slightest deviation, everything is lost. And we can't, just like we can't compromise with regard to stealing a penny, certainly within relation to God, there cannot be any compromise. And the Messianic movement Well, you'll see my article in the Gap when it comes out, but I discussed that pretty much as to why this movement was considered idolatrous even in its infancy, before they deified Jesus. But you have to remember here, and that's important, that the guardians of the Torah, and that the guardians of the Torah, the same guardians that we have today, the ones that have been from different times, Moses, the Pharisees, are the ones that what they're guarding the most is the proper idea of God. Any deviation, if a person's emotions are false in that area, they're not on target, he is considered the greatest danger, is considered a heretic. And as a matter of fact, you know very well, Spinoza believed in God. I mean, his whole philosophy was riddled with the idea of God. He couldn't breathe without the idea of God. But nevertheless, he was pronounced a heretic, because his idea of pantheism meant that God actually has extension, which means that the universe is a part of God. And this idea was heretical, stated as heretical, and a ban was placed on him, and he was excommunicated. And the reason, again, is because we can't tolerate the slightest deviation. And if a person, that's one of the problems, by the way, with the Kabbalah, and that's why you're very fortunate to have someone like David, who knows the pitfalls and the dangers of that kind of study, because that can cause a person to have a distorted notion of God. And once you have that, you are considered lost in the eyes of the Torah. An atheist is just as bad, or an agnostic is just as bad as one, well, perhaps an agnostic is not as bad as one who serves a strange God, because an agnostic is saying, I don't know. But an atheist is saying there is no God, he is just as bad, he's included in the same thing, the same category as an idolater. There is no difference between an idolater and an atheist, they're both exactly the same. Or anyone who believes in sub-deities, or who prays to anyone other than God, all these things are considered heresy and apostasy, and anyone who partakes of that really has no part in the God of Israel. So you have to understand how these guardians of Torah didn't make this blessing to be vicious. The blessing was made, again, because of true kindness, that those who are innocent should not be destroyed by these individuals who are enticing these people to go away from the Torah, away from God. So, if you read the English of this prayer, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. Okay, now, the Talmud states that the, of course, there's an order, as we said, to all of these blessings. And the order is, I want you to know that most, practically all the blessings, the formulations, the wording, I haven't had time to go through this, but all the wording is straight from the prophets, with a little bit, just enough of a variation to get by. But it's practically all the words are from somewhere in the prophets. And that is, again, because the 120 scholars, and among them were many prophets, that got together to write the prayers, when they did it, they were very, very cautious, as I said, to make sure to say only the right things before the Creator, and they based everything that they could on the words of the prophets. Of course, we know the prophet speaks properly, and therefore, even insofar as the language is concerned, they based it on the words as closely as possible on the words of the prophets. Now, the Talmud states that the order over here is as follows. That, after we get finished with the blessing, where we ask God for our sustenance, so then we start with the universal blessings. And, the idea that man is finished with his personal now, he should be concerned with the rest of the humanity, and he asks, the first blessing that he asks for is for the call of the sound of the great horn, great shofar, to bring all of the gathering, all the those who are scattered from the four corners of the earth. Okay, that is the first blessing. Then the second one is, as the one mentioned before, is the return of the judges. Now, why is that order followed? So the Talmud states that this is based on Isaiah 1. If you take a look at Isaiah 1, you'll see that at the end of Isaiah 1, let me just get mine, okay, the end of Isaiah 1, towards the end, I should say. It's 125. Okay? So in 125, it states that I will place my hand upon you, and then I will cleanse you. All right? The literal translation of that is, you know, this translation is wrong. I'm surprised. This is the JPS translation. It's incorrect. It says, and I will turn my hand against you. That's wrong. That's incorrect. And I will place my hand upon you. It's a positive thing. And then it says, and I will purge away the dross as with lye, and take away all the base alloy. And then it says, and I will bring back your judges as of before. And see, that's the exact same verse, by the way. Hashiv Shoftenik Varishon is based on this verse. Return the judges as of before, and the counselors, okay, as in the beginning. That's the exact same, it's verbatim. As I said, they always try to imitate, stay as close as possible to the prophets. Okay? So, the Talmud states that, okay. That it was after God, when it says God will place his hand upon the Jewish people, what it means is that he will bring them back. Because placing his hand implies he's doing something. What is he doing? He's bringing them back from their state of dispersion. Okay. Then after that, it states that, and I will give you back your judges as before. So you see, the order will be, and this is, actually these blessings that we're dealing with here have something to do with a messianic order. So first, there will be a gathering of the people back to the Holy Land, and then there will be a return of the judges. Okay? Interesting. Now, once the judges come, so then the then the destruction of the wicked will take place, and once the wicked are destroyed, then the so that's why you have after the judges you have the destruction of the wicked, okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right. Once those who do not believe in the Torah, that's the blessing we just did, once they are destroyed, so then what will happen is that the righteous will be raised up. Because this is based on a verse in Psalm 75, where it says that I will... Psalm 75:11. All the horns of the wicked will I cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be exalted. So based on the Talmud says that the next blessing, which is dealing with the righteous, follows the previous one. In other words, the one that we just did is the cutting off the horns of the wicked. That's the destruction of the wicked. And once the wicked are destroyed, so then what will happen is that the righteous will become exalted. This is all speaking about in the time of the ultimate redemption. And with that, we go into the next blessing, where we pray for those who are righteous. And actually, there's two terms there, tzaddik and chassid. Tzaddik means righteous. Chassid is even a higher level of righteousness. But I'll get back to that. Maybe next week I'll differentiate between those two terms. But I'd like to finish the blessing this week. So, and then we say, and the elders of Israel, which means those who have knowledge. It doesn't mean old in age. It means old in wisdom. And then we say, we mention over here also the Gerei HaTzedek. The Gerei HaTzedek, that means the ones who were the converts. And then we say, and upon us. And that's why a Ben Noach can read this just perfectly, because when he says, and upon us, he's referring to himself as well. So he says that God should have compassion, and he should give proper reward to all those who believe in his name and truth, and he should place our portion with them, and we will not be will not be ashamed, because we believe in you, meaning God. And then we say God is the one who supports the righteous. Okay, now. You may wonder as to why there is no inclusion here of the Ben Noach, and it's a good question. It's a good question. I was wondering about it myself. The only answer that I have is, you see, the prayer really is not for specific individuals, but it really is for groups of people. At that time, the time that the prayer was formulated, there were no groups. There was no considerable group of Bnei Noach. There were only individuals. And it's true that we do mention the convert, who is an individual, but the Talmud explains that. The Talmud says that the reason is because in the Torah, where it says that you should stand up for a wise man, so right after that it says, and if there live among you a sojourner,
Rabbi, you got 1 minute.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that's why the sojourner is, the ger is included, so to speak, in the group. But it's not a specific blessing for him. But the reason why the Ben Noach wasn't included was because at that time there was no real group, so to speak, of Bnei Noach. But when you pray, of course, You are including yourself, and that's fine. This blessing is fine for a Ben Noach, as well as the previous ones. There's no need for any changes there, except as I mentioned last week, when we say our judges, say the judges of Israel, okay, and the advisors of Israel. I'm afraid I'm not going to make it in a minute, so I think we're just going to have to stop at this point.
Well, that's a good place to break off.
Okay.
And we'll pick it up, and you're going to have a good Purim party tomorrow?
Yeah.